I feel like I'm kind of standing up here under false pretenses. I feel somehow I ought to be wearing John's suit and hat and kind of and wig and all the all the Willy Wonka stuff if I'm doing it with the backdrop behind me. But we'll kind of give that a miss if that's all right. I'd much rather let my staff embarrass themselves than embarrass myself. So I'm sorry you get to miss out on that one. I know it's Palm Sunday, but I want to jump a week. I hope you forgive me. But I want just to take the opportunity today. We've been following on this series through Psalms, and it would have been really easy to kind of pick up on some of the Psalms to actually foretell the triumphant kind of entry of Jesus into Jerusalem. But actually, I wanted to move on a week to the cross and have Psalm 22 and spend the last of our time reflecting on the Psalms, reflecting on Jesus' death and Jesus' suffering. And I'm partly very aware that we always have a family service on Good Friday. And it actually, it's not like it's dumbed down. Often, because we're doing something physical to kind of think about Jesus' death, it can be incredibly powerful. But there's not time for a kind of a longer talk. There's not time to dig much deeper into the cross. And this psalm gives us an opportunity to do that. So kind of rather than our thoughts being on Palm Sunday, really they're much more on Good Friday today and very much on the cross. Not sure whether it was Dedo or Bob pointed out earlier in this series that more of the Psalms are laments than kind of songs of praise. And today is another lament. Laments ask the big questions of faith. Where is God when it hurts? Why don't I see the answers to the prayers that I long for? It's not to say that we don't necessarily see answers to the prayers, but sometimes they're not the answers that we want. Is God really in control when everything seems to be crashing around me? And you see often kind of in the refrain of the psalmists, they often recount the deeds of God in the past. And there's this kind of sense of, that's what you did, but why are we not seeing that now? Why is this gulf between the deeds of old and our experience today? And I suppose one of the things that I like about the psalmists, and I hope it gives us permission to be the same, is that they're brutally honest. And sometimes I think in ways that we would hesitate to be so. And I hope that encourages us to be real about our struggles and our questions. And it makes me very aware, and please forgive me if I drift into this, I'm just so concerned that at times as Christians, when things are tough, what we trot out kind of is superficial, it's kind of platitudes. And actually the psalmists don't bring platitudes to us, they don't bring platitudes to God, they bring kind of brutal honesty in their questioning, even when there isn't at times answers. So this psalm is a psalm of David. It's another lament. It's not clear its original context. It speaks of David's unprovoked suffering. It's not something he deserves at the hands of his enemies. And it speaks of the fact that he feels that he's not being vindicated by God. And he questions kind of where God is in all of that. It's actually, for those of you that kind of like a fact or two in a message, it's also the most quoted psalm in the New Testament. And many of those quotes kind of are associated with the last hours of Jesus' life. And I'll just take us through the slides as we go, so I'll just ask for the next one. Could I have it, Bob? Rob, is that okay? Thanks. The most obvious of those is the opening verse. Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, which means, as we have written here in the psalm, my God, why have you forsaken me? And I don't know about you, I just find it amazing that words written 1,000 years before the death of Jesus can describe his death so clearly. A little later on, we read in this psalm about, it's hard to put in the context of David. It fits almost more readily into the context of Jesus. We read about his hands and his feet literally being pierced And so kind of, yeah, it's like this psalm is taking us on a journey to the cross. And if you're one of those that are still trying to make sense of faith and where you fit into it, if you're someone that has got questions about faith, you know, this provides us with incredible evidence for God working his purposes out in Jesus, the way that it's foretold so clearly. Let's just pick up on some of those things. Again, on this slide, verse 7, it talks about all who see me mock me. They hurl insults. They shake their heads. And we read in Matthew 27, when Jesus is on the cross, those who pass by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads. Now, I know it's kind of Matthew phrasing what he sees happening on the cross, but it's as if what David writes about 1,000 years before is played out before the eyes of the disciples. And the next slide, thanks, Rob. Verse 8, he trusts in the Lord. Let the Lord rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. And again, you know, the words of the people kind of throwing their accusations against Jesus when he's on the cross in Matthew's gospel. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him. Verse 18, they divide my garments among me and they cast lots for my clothing. And in Matthew 27, when they crucified him, they divided up his clothes by casting lots. And let's just jump on. It isn't just actual quotes. It just seems to me that there's so much in this psalm that connects us with Jesus' last hours, that connects us with Jesus' death. We've already talked about the piercing of his hands and his feet in verse 16. But verse 15 says, my strength is dried up like a potsherd and my tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. And in John's gospel, it talks about Jesus being thirsty. And it talks about him giving up his spirit. It says, knowing that all was now completed and the scripture was fulfilled, Jesus said, I am thirsty. And when he received the drink, Jesus said, it is finished. And with that, he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. It begs a bit of a question, doesn't it, really? You know, is Jesus sort of actively trying to fulfill these prophecies? Now, I don't think so in the sense of trying to substantiate his claims to messiahship. I don't know how anyone could be going through the suffering they are going through, in the case of Jesus on the cross, and still be trying to control events. But I think perhaps in another sense, there's a sense that Jesus chooses to enter into what his Father asks of him. There's that whole thing in Gethsemane where he says, you know, I would want this cup to be taken from me, but not my will, your will. And there's this sense of Jesus entering into his God's will, into his Father's will, not just kind of what his Father is saying to him there and then, but what he knows to be God's will, because he knows the scriptures. And actually, when you think about these things, actually, a lot of them are just beyond Jesus to make happen. He couldn't control whether they would cast lots for his clothes or not. But we see in it his perfect submission to his Father. And the allusions continue. Verse 6, I'm a worm, not a man, scorned by men and despised by the people. I don't know about you, but it echoes not just the New Testament, but it also echoes Isaiah's prophecy in chapter 53. He was despised and he was rejected by men, a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering, like one from whom men hide their faces. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. If you're using the devotional material, this psalm is one of the psalms for this week. But I would just encourage you to live in this psalm this whole week, if you've got the time to do that, as well as reading the other psalms. Because it just seems to me it takes us not just on a journey with David. It does take us on a journey with David, because here we have David being real about his pain, but it takes us with Jesus on a journey to the cross. And it reminds us of what that meant for him. Can we go on a slide? Thanks, Rob. That's brilliant. It seems to me that part of the path of this psalm is that it doesn't just echo David's suffering. It doesn't just echo Jesus' suffering. In some way, it echoes our own pain. Those questions, where is God when we're hurting? It echoes our struggles. You brought me out of the womb. You made me trust in you, even at my mother's breath. From my earth, I was cast upon you. From my mother's womb, you've been my God. This is a person of faith, as we are, but struggling with what, you know, I've trusted you, Lord. And where are you now when all of these things are going on? And I think the psalmist is expressing what we feel, that we've trusted God, but at times when we need him the most, it feels like he's not there. And he's honest about that. And I suspect, you know, he's not alone in that. You know, why are you so far from saving me? So far from the words of my groaning? And it's like he's crying out, and where's God? My God, I cry out by day, but you don't answer. By night, and I'm not silent. So it connects with us, and it connects with our experience, our struggles, as well as David's struggles. But I think it also reveals something to us of the heart of God. We see God entering into our suffering. And we live in a world that, it's horrible to say, isn't it? But, you know, I think at times we wish we could say we live in a world that is characterized by joy and delight. But actually, often it feels like we live in a world that is more characterized by suffering than by anything else. I suspect I'm not alone in being actually really, I was surprised how much I was impacted and affected by the death of Peter Skeldoff this week. Am I alone in that? Were people shocked by that? Nod, shake your heads. It just somehow amazed me how someone who I only know from a photograph or seeing on television or a bit about her family, someone who I don't know, could impact me in that way. And although, you know, most people don't know her, somehow her death has impacted lots of people. Even with its perhaps particularly because of the unanswered questions about her death. And I just think perhaps that actually there are a lot of ways that actually we identify with her. It can be because of her age and her beauty. You know, as a parent, the thought of losing my child in the way that Bob Geldof has lost his daughter, it is beyond comprehension to know what that would be like to happen. It's in part because she's the mother of two young children, and the thought of, as a husband, of losing a wife, and as children, of losing a mother in those circumstances. You know, it touches something inside us that disturbs us deeply. And I think perhaps even the unanswered questions, they are unanswered about why and how and whether they ever will be, we don't know. And I suspect that will be particularly hard for her family. But somehow they seem to touch and connect with just the lostness of our world, of lost youth. It's like the words in Ecclesiastes, where again and again the writer talks about, you know, life being meaningless. You know, what's the point of life if life is snatched away like this? So we live in a world that, you know, where pain and suffering is unavoidable. And when we face pain and suffering in our own lives, it often feels like our prayers go unanswered. And the question that is most asked is why? Many of you have asked questions like that of me. And this is where I'm just really frightened that I will be superficial, because I don't want to be. it seems to me often when we come to the specific stuff, there are no neat or tidy answers. Yes, there are big pictures that are in the background. We live in a broken world. We live in a world marred by sin that is far from what God intended it to be. We know that as Christians that we don't get an exemption clause from that we're part of that world, and that suffering touches our lives just as it touches others. But when it comes to my situation, the person I love, or the thing that I'm dealing with, we want an answer, and it feels like there isn't one. And actually, I don't think there is. You know, David is hunting for answers here, and they don't come to him. But what this psalm does point to is the heart of God. It is interesting, actually, when you think about how different faiths or different societies portray God. I guess the most ridiculous is kind of the Roman gods and the Greek gods, which kind of have these larger-than-life gods with great vices, but actually are characterized by one thing. They don't really care about anyone else. They just wreak their havoc and they stand at a distance. That's not the picture that this psalm paints of God. It's not the picture that the Bible paints of God. The picture we have comes from Jesus. It comes not just from this psalm, but from the fulfillment of this psalm. And it's not a God that stands aloof and is unmoved by the suffering of those he's created. It's a picture of a God that chooses to enter in. A God that chooses to share in our humanity. Rob, would you mind? Thank you. This is Paul's description. Who, being in the very nature God, didn't consider equality with God something to be grasped or used for his own advantage. Rather, this is a God who chooses to make himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, by being made in human likeness and being found in appearance as a man. He humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. In Christ, God doesn't just enter into our humanity. He enters into our suffering. He enters into our pain. And this is no way meant to minimize the pain that we have. But it's hard to comprehend a greater pain and a greater suffering than what Jesus chose to endure for us. And unlike us, when we face pain and suffering, and there is no way of getting away from it, we can't walk away from it. That's the terrible thing. When we are facing a doctor's diagnosis of someone we love, you can't walk away from it. It's there. Jesus has a choice. He can walk away, but he chooses to enter in and not have that cup pass from his lips. He's betrayed, he's unjustly tried, he's deserted by his friends, flogged, beaten, stripped, completely humiliated. Despite his weakness, he's forced to carry the means of his own crucifixion, his own death, through streets of people baying for his blood and ridiculing him. He's nailed to a cross. He enters into our suffering. He enters into our suffering. And even now, in heaven, he has our humanity. The incarnation doesn't end when he returns to his Father. The God we trust in is the God-man who shares that and still carries the marks of the suffering. The marks in his hands and his feet and his side. He carries it into eternity. That's the God we trust in. The God that enters in to our suffering. Doesn't give us the answers. Doesn't explain why what is happening to us is happening. But we know that the one that is ultimately in control understands, because he too has suffered and still carries the marks of it. And we know that that's the depth of his love for us. Even if at times he feels distant, that's how much he loved us. We know we're not alone, even if it feels like God is distant. We find it hard to find purpose in our suffering, but the Bible does portray purpose in Jesus' suffering. Thank you, Rob. And this heart psalm hints at that purpose. A purpose more fully revealed on the cross. As the hour approaches, darkness covers the land. From the 6,000 and the 9th, Matthew says, darkness came over the land. Now, historians talk about an eclipse, but the physical reason for it is not my concern. It's as if all of the malevolent, all of the horrible forces of suffering and death in this world are being focused on Jesus. And in the midst of it, he carries our sin himself. And that's the only way we can account for the words that begin this psalm. Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani? My God, why have you forsaken me? It's actually perhaps the heart of Jesus is suffering. You know, if I've got this wrong, and Bob's not here to theologically correct me, but if anyone else knows their Bible better, I think this is the only time I can recall Jesus addressing his Father as God. And I could be wrong, but I'm sure that that's the case. It's the only time where instead of saying Father, he says God. And it's like that bond that he shared, that intimate relationship has been severed as our sin is placed on him. And he's separated from the Father that loves him. It's the cry of dereliction. And he addresses his Father as God. Because all the things that separate us from God are being placed on him. He's taking our place. Now, theologically, that's kind of complicated. I don't know how God can be separated from God, the Father from the Son. But theologically, that is what's happening here. Peter writes about it like this. To this you were called because Christ suffered for you. It's interesting, isn't it? He makes a link between human suffering, our suffering, and Christ's suffering. Leaving you an example, you should follow you in his steps. We talk about following Jesus in lots of ways. We don't want to often talk about following him in terms of suffering. He committed no sin, and no deceit was found in his mouth. When they hurled insults at him, he didn't retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the cross so that we might die to sin and live for righteousness. By his wounds, you've been healed. For you were like sheep going astray. But now you've returned to the shepherd and the overseer of your souls. and it may be hard to find a purpose in our suffering. But we see purpose in his suffering. Jesus' death is mercifully short, a matter of hours. It took people generally a long time to die by crucifixion. Often they die from exposure and weakness, their life ebbing away. Sometimes, and it's why they broke their legs, it put pressure on their hearts and the blood vessels would break. But it's Jesus' heart that breaks as he carries the sin of the world. It's not necessary to do those things. He cries, "It's finished," and he gives up his spirit. He dies of a broken heart, but he dies having accomplished what he came to do. It truly is finished. A purpose to his suffering. And as he dies, the curtain in the temple that separates the holy place from the most holy place, the thing that symbolizes in Judaism more than anything else, the fact that God is distant, is torn in two. And it's like when Jesus dies, God is saying, "Come in. My arms are wide to welcome you. You're welcome here." What a powerful picture of that purpose being fulfilled. We're going to close with just some music to stop and to reflect on the cross, to reflect on the God that enters in, Clive.